This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
ISIS is very keen on emphasizing lately that all branches of the caliphate, quote-unquote, are still loyal to Baghdadi.
That's terrorism expert Ehud Yari about the ongoing security threat in Egypt's Sinai region. Details coming up also. Zimbabwe's finance minister seems to be doing everything by the book, yet inflation in that country has soared to its highest level in a decade. We'll have a discussion. And food and drink company PepsiCo has agreed to buy South Africa's Pioneer Food Group for $1.7 billion. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Thank you so much, sir. So, yes.
Our top story, Zimbabwe's finance minister, Mthuli Ncube, seems to be doing everything by the book as he pursues orthodox economy policy to mend the ailing Zimbabwean economy. The government is running a budget surplus for the first time in years and has stopped runaway money printing, which led to hyperinflation of 500% in 2008. Last month, the central bank raised its overnight lending rate to 50% to protect the local currency. Ncube, a former chief economist at the African Development Bank, has even agreed to a staff monitoring program with the IMF in May, under which Harare promised not to borrow offshore and to cut a reliance on the central bank to finance deficits. All that points to a government willing to break with the disastrous policies of the past under former President Robert Mugabe, according to economic analysts. Yet Zimbabwe's inflation has soared to its highest level in a decade, hitting an annual 175% in June. To shed light on the matter, we have in studio Gibbs Dube from VOA Zimbabwe Service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you so much, sir.
So, Gibbs, the government is trying hard, but nothing is working. What is wrong here?
Now, it seems as if the government is actually trying by all means to get investors, is trying to come out with some policies that are pointing towards, you know, transforming the economy. But the problem is that, you know, the basic economic fundamentals are not in place. So the first problem is that there is very little production coming out of Zimbabwe, in which, you know, when you produce a lot of commodities, you have to, you know, sell outside the country and get foreign currency. So foreign currency has become a very, very serious problem. So as we speak right now, there is a critical shortage of fuel. And as we speak as well, there are serious power cuts of up to about 18 hours a day. So meaning that there is almost some darkness in the country. So as you said, the finance minister is trying by all means to come out with some policies as per some, you know, economic theories. Yes, that is working, but in practice it's not. We saw 2 days ago a Russian delegation from Amoroso, is a diamond company. So they are saying that they've come to Zimbabwe to actually invest in the diamond mining field, in the diamond industry. But then the problem is these investors are coming without any kind of indications that they are going to generate money for Zimbabwe as well, in terms of taxes and all those kind of things, and even foreign currency. And the crisis now has gone to workers. So workers right now are demanding 4,000 Zimbabwe dollars, and that is an equivalent of about $475 per worker. So, but the government is saying it doesn't have money. Today, you know, the government actually gave workers a cushioning allowance of $400, meaning that each worker is going to get about $45 this month. Next month, we don't know. It could be three times that, which means, you know, all these things are actually, you know, fueling inflation. As you said, the inflation rate now is 175.66%, is the highest in a decade. So meaning that maybe the country is going back to the 2008 scenario where, you know, there was stratospheric inflation in which, you know, it was beyond measure. So at the end of the day, the government is trying to do the right things, but it's not getting there. I think what needs to be done is for the government now to say, like what other critics are saying, go into a unity government and try to maybe bring in the opposition and see what can happen. So, but the government appears to be dragging its feet. You know, when you get power, sometimes you have to spend it somehow. You know, that's politics.
So when it rains, it pours. A severe drought has left a third of the 15 million population needing for food. So has that put fuel on the fire too?
Yes, yes, certainly. It seems as if many people, up to about between 4 and 5 million people, will need state aid. And this state aid has to be, you know, sourced from other countries. But the country is really facing serious problems with foreign currency. So it is in a big fix. And I don't know how they are going to get out of this thing. But at the end of the day, like what I said, people are actually recommending that maybe there should be some kind of national transitional authority or a government of national unity, like in the 2009 scenario. It actually worked when, you know... Morgan Tsvangirai was still alive. And Mr. Tendai Biti, who was the then finance minister, actually pushed until people could get some food on the table. But right now, as we speak, you know, farm workers are getting 135 Zimbabwe dollars, which is $15.50 per month. And that's not enough to buy even the most basic things. So it's really tough.
Gibbs Dube from VOA Zimbabwe Service, thank you for your input.
Thank you so much.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has stressed the need for his armed forces to adopt the latest armaments and training technologies to catch up with the armed forces of developed nations. He hailed the army's sacrifices as a suicide bomb attack in northern Sinai killed one member of the security forces and a civilian and wounded three others. North Sinai has long been a hot spot of Islamist insurgents affiliated with the extremist Islamic State group. Last year, Sisi pledged to wipe out terrorism in Sinai, but the militants continue to strike. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Ehud Yari, a terrorism expert and a fellow at the Washington Institute for Middle East Policy, about the ongoing security threat in Sinai and what is missing in the Egyptian army campaign to uproot terrorists.
Well, I think the situation in northern Sinai has improved considerably over the past 2 years or so, but it's still very fragile. And the Egyptian military, in spite of great efforts that they have been making, especially the Second Army, and to an extent also the Egyptian Air Force, they are unable so far to uproot ISIS completely from their support base amongst some of the Bedouin tribes in the peninsula. So we keep having incidents less frequently than we used to see before, but the ISIS cadres there are still capable of mounting, unfortunately, infrequently, ambushes and mount attacks against both the Egyptian military and civilians suspected by them to collaborate with the Egyptian intelligence.
On Wednesday, families of local citizens had reported that militants stopped several cars before taking five people away and forcing them to lie down on the ground, and they beheaded four of them and kidnapped the fifth. Islamic State claimed responsibility for that, saying the four were spies for the Egyptian military. How serious is such terrorist act in Sinai?
ISIS is very keen on emphasizing lately that all branches of the caliphate, quote-unquote, are still loyal to Baghdadi. So they had ISIS Sinai, amongst many other branches, issue a statement swearing allegiance to the Caliph Baghdadi. As part of this, they issued also videos in which they show different operations, such as this beheading in the Sinai. They do that in order to scare some of the leaders of the tribal leaders of different clans in the Sinai that feel that they are compelled to cooperate with the Egyptian military intelligence. And this is one of the more frequent phenomena that we see in the Sinai.
Egypt's military launched a comprehensive campaign in Sinai in November 2017, and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi pledged to eradicate terrorism in a few months. What's missing in this operation?
Frankly, the Egyptian army is investing a lot of effort, manpower, and money in the Sinai, led by the Second Army. However, their performance in the Sinai is not structured as a counter-terrorist operation, but more as a counter-insurgency operation. And that means that the Egyptian army is employing a lot of force, sometimes unnecessarily. They create tension between the military and many in the civilian population, the inhabitants of the Sinai. And the third point is that the Egyptian Air Force is not proving as successful as one would have hoped for in targeting the different enclaves in which ISIS elements thrive. That led in quite a few cases to the intervention of the Israeli Air Force, hitting ISIS targets in the Sinai, all very quietly, unannounced, but reported. But still, I think that the main weakness of the Egyptian military in the Sinai is that they have lost much of their intelligence gathering capability in the years following the fall of the Mubarak regime.
That was Ehud Yari, a terrorism expert and a fellow at the Washington Institute for Middle East Policy. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Liberia's House of Representatives is holding a one-day conference on crafting a law to establish a specialized court to prosecute people who committed atrocities during the country's civil war. An estimated 250,000 people are believed to have died in one of the world's deadliest civil conflicts, which lasted close to 14 years in the West African state. The United Kingdom-based Nottingham University Human Rights Law Center, Civitas Maxima, and the Secretariat for the Establishment of War and Economic Crimes Court in Liberia are supporting the House Committee on Claims and Petition in hosting the conference. Moses Caruso reports from Monrovia.
The conference is bringing together civil society organizations who have been championing the establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Court, along with international organizations and partners, including the UN Human Rights Office. The House of Representatives is seeking ideas on the crimes that constitute war crimes. Rosalind Dennis is the House Committee Chairman on Claims and Petition.
Legislators need a clearer understanding on this whole specialized criminal court, who can be indicted, who can be vindicated based on your involvement in the civil war. And I think that has been a sticky issue for the committee.
Since the inception of the George Weah regime, there has been more pressure mounted on the government by different civil society groupings calling for the establishment of War and Economic Crimes Court in Liberia. Dennis says the prosecution of people who committed crimes against the state is long overdue.
This is something that is way belated. I am shocked and bewildered. I'm also baffled that at this point in time in the history of Liberia, that the Liberians or the leadership will not want to hold people accountable for past crimes that they've committed against humanity. We listen to international media. We have the U.S. doing arrests, France doing arrests, Belgium doing arrests for would-be violators in the Liberian crisis. And Liberia as a nation cannot do any form of arrest.
Public international law professor from the UK-based University of Nottingham, Olympia Beko, is in Liberia to assist the legislature and the National Bar Association on the possibility of the court. She said victims getting redressed through an international bar court is necessary for justice.
I think it is important to give victims redress. It is important for victims to have their stories heard in the court in order to get closure. Studies have shown that when you have an international justice process, victims get closure, even if that happened a long time ago. So it is important also in the context of a particular trial to set the record straight as to what happened to that particular victim.
After the Civil War ended, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up to hear testimonies from victims and perpetrators of the crisis. The TRSC made 207 recommendations, including the establishment of a special criminal tribunal to prosecute people who committed major atrocities. John Stewart, one of the disbanded TRSC commissioners, told the conference the Liberian judiciary is too corrupt to handle a case of such magnitude.
We know our judges are corrupt. There are numerous human rights reports that have acknowledged justice is for sale in Liberian courts, and judges routinely are bribed to handle cases. So we were very apprehensive. The executive has always interfered with the judiciary. We did not trust to leave such an important task in the hands of a corrupt judiciary.
The law to establish a court will require a two-term majority in the House to pass the bill. It then will go to the Senate before being sent to WIA to sign for implementation. Until then, victims will continue to wait while some perpetrators enjoy top government positions. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
20 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The German rescue ship captain who allegedly disobeyed Italy's ban on migrant ships voiced hope yesterday that EU countries would allow migrants in the future. Carola Rakiti spoke after she was questioned by a Sicilian court on suspicion of aiding illegal immigration. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Shouts of brava along with applause greeted Carola Rakete as she left court in the town of Agrigento after just under 4 hours of questioning. Demonstrators outside the courtroom held banners which read, "Saving lives at sea is not a crime." The 31-year-old Rakete told reporters she was pleased to have told the court why she entered the port of Lampedusa in late June after 2 weeks at sea in international waters. Rakete was arrested June 29th after defying orders to stay out of the port and hitting a police boat with her ship, the Sea-Watch 3, with migrants on board. A judge in Agrigento subsequently released her from house arrest, saying the captain followed the law of the sea, which is first and foremost to save the lives of endangered people. The captain has said she docked at Lampedusa because she feared for the health of her migrant passengers. Rakete told journalists she hoped the new European Union Commission would let migrants such as those she had rescued enter those countries without facing added impediments.
I sincerely hope that the European Commission, now after the new election of the Parliament, will do their very best to prevent situations like that happening, and that all the European countries will work together in the future to accept any people which the civilian fleet has rescued.
The Italian government has adopted a tough position against illegal immigration. Authorities have imposed a policy that effectively stops non-governmental organization ships with rescued migrants from entering Italian waters. In the case of Rakete, investigators say she will not undergo further questioning. Rakete's lawyers also say she is free to return to Germany if she so desires and that no arrest has been confirmed. Additionally, the lawyers say Rakete is no longer the captain of the Sea-Watch as there has been a change in crew. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
U.S. food and drink company PepsiCo has agreed to buy South Africa's Pioneer Food Group for $1.7 billion. The companies announced the deal today and lifted Pioneer share price. PepsiCo owns some of the best-known U.S. food brands such as Pepsi Cola, Frito-Lay chips, Quaker Oats, and Tropicana juices. The company said Pioneer's portfolio is complementary to its own and will help the company expand in sub-Saharan Africa. Pioneer brands include the popular Licky Fruit Juice and Weet-Bix cereal. The deal comes as many food production companies in South Africa are struggling. Consumers have cut back on purchases because of the poor economy, and dry weather has reduced grain harvests in southern Africa. Paul Ingeroge's wife, children, and mother-in-law died earlier this year in the Ethiopian Airlines 737 MAX crash. This week, he testified before members of the U.S. Congress about the crash and what he and other relatives of the crash victims think should have been done to prevent the accident. Today, the Canadian financial analyst, Paul Ingeroge, was at VOA. He came to talk about his mission to make sure Boeing, the maker of the 737 MAX jets, fixes the problems believed to have caused the Ethiopian Airlines crash, as well as the similar Lion Air crash last year in Indonesia. One factor delaying action, he says, was that both crashes were in developing countries.
Obviously, you know, somebody might think that I'm trying to be political, but you know, if that crash happened in the United States, there would have been a lot of calls for the plane to be grounded at that point. But I think Boeing did not feel compelled to do that because the first crash happened in Indonesia, and the first crash killed 189 people, of which 187 were Indonesians, one Italian and one Indian. There was no American.
The families of the crash victims are urging the U.S. Congress to better fund the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA. They also want to stop the practice of allowing aircraft manufacturers to certify the safety of their planes. They say that duty should be done by the FAA. In northern Senegal, the picturesque city of St. Louis is full of local art and boutiques, but the Atelier de Femmes is different, not only in that it teaches women of all ages and backgrounds how to sew and crochet, but also that it uses entirely recycled materials to make a wide variety of products. In St. Louis, Isha Sarai has more.
The Atelier de Femmes in St. Louis is a bit different than all of the other boutiques on these narrow streets. The Atelier, run by a group called La Lienne, which houses children and women in need, teaches women how to sew and crochet, all with recycled materials. Marietou Diop is one of the sewing instructors. Diop says that a lot of women who come to the Atelier know how to crochet, but have only done so with yarn. Women who come to the Atelier learn how to cut up plastic bags to make a type of string and crochet with that instead. Yundu Nyang, who works at the Atelier and boutique every morning, says they're helping the development of the country. Nyang says by collecting the bags, they're reducing litter around the city. Whether using plastic or not, some women at the Atelier, like Ines, learned how to sew for the first time. Ines, who is sewing batik fabric edges onto a placemat while her 10-month-old daughter sleeps on the bench of the boutique, says that before she came to the Atelier 6 months ago, she hadn't thought she would ever use a sewing machine. Once the women have finished their training, anything they make is sold in the Atelier's boutique and a percentage of the profit comes back to them. But beyond the money and skills they gain, these women say the sense of family in the Atelier keeps them coming back. Nyang says that she sees herself in the association. She's truly touched by how the Atelier has helped women in need, and its continued devotion to helping women in the community get an education and work on their craft is why she has stayed on staff for the past 9 years. Whether they spend only a few afternoons at the Atelier or work there daily, every woman who passes through leaves her mark in the community and her products in the boutique. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Saint Louis.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.